Thank you, David. And thank you to the Allen Institute for asking me to come along here today. By the way, I'll never forgive you for getting me onto Twitter. It's seriously addictive, right? Taking up far too much of my time. Just before I left home this morning, my wife asked me, had I seen a YouTube video? And I thought I'd mention it because if we're going to go to this like post-human future where we're going to basically exist in the interweb better be there, right? And so there's, if you know Foyle, what is it, Arms and Hogg, the comedy trio, they have something called The Internet Is Down, where they find themselves in the cottage somewhere and they have no internet, they have no connections, and they go into this incredible panic. Okay, if that was to happen, obviously, in this future that we're projecting, we'd all be scuppered because it'd all cease to exist. But anyway, just a bit of fun. Anyway, now I've handed out a, there should be a handout there if anybody hasn't got it, there's some more up in front. And I'll come to it in a minute. There's a brief bibliography in relation to what I'm talking about today. And what I've put on that is I put my book on transgenderism because that's all you need to know. Buy multiple copies, okay? Because I need to go to the Bahamas urgently. Okay. On transhumanism, I have put down many, but the one that is probably the easiest kind of introduction and an easy read is Mark O'Connell's To Be a Machine, right? But just to show you, there is absolutely no shortage of material. Look, I just grabbed a handful of stuff. Everybody and his grandmother, okay, is writing about this. Okay, it's like no shortage. So on the bibliography, I put some of the links to those books, and I've also linked to some websites that you can go to in case you don't want to spend any money on the books, which would be perfectly understandable. And on the back, there's something which I'm going to come to in a little while. Anyway, so welcome to our brave new world, a world of transhumanism and artificial intelligence and the Anthropocene anti-humanist perspective. I love this one. I'm going to tell you about that. I can't talk about everything in the time we have today, even if I knew everything about it, which I don't. Okay. So I'll postpone discussion of the Anthropocene anti-humanism, except to say that its particular formula is to contend, like Private Fraser in Dad's Army, we're doomed. Okay, and a good thing too, right? Which Fraser didn't say. Okay, if you want to know more about it, then this little book, which one is it? My God, he gave me so much. Yeah, this is one. Which, see, David, he knows what's going to wind me up, and he keeps sending me these books, right? Which would make me think. And if there's anything I hate doing, it's thinking. Okay, but what can I say? So this tiny little book, okay, if you want a quick overview, is very useful. It's called The Revolt Against Humanity: Imagining a Future Without Us by Adam Kirsch. Tiny little book, you read it in a couple of hours, okay? And it's very informative. Anyway, so he gave me this to annoy me. So if I had to sum up the Anthropocene anti-humanist position in a single phrase, I would describe it as anthropomorphic ultra-romanticism. Ooh, what's that? Well, what that means is the attribution of ultimate moral value to non-human entities, amounting to treating them as persons, while at the same time deprecating human beings as some kind of biological infestation that nature, with a capital N, needs to eliminate. So their view is we're all going to die, and a good thing too, because then nature, the world, will come back and it'll all be wonderful. Of course, we won't be here to enjoy it or to ruin it, but it'll be wonderful. I don't really know what to say about it, except it's bonkers. But that's a technical term, by the way. All right. So I'll leave that to one side. So anyway, if you're puzzled about the ideas, well, welcome to the club. So is everybody else. And so I'm going to start by talking about artificial intelligence. So the acronym is obviously AI, which used to be, by the way, of course, the acronym for artificial insemination. And they're not unrelated. But anyway, okay. It's the ability of a computer or any other machine to perform activities that are normally thought to require intelligence, and more generally, intelligence exhibited by a non-natural man-made entity. So that's artificial intelligence. It's certainly artificial. To what extent this intelligence, of course, is a moot point, and I'll come back to that. Now, there's no end of material online about this phenomenon, and I give a link to a scary video down at the bottom, right at the bottom of the bibliography there. It says scary YouTube video on AI, and you see that link? Okay, and that comes from somebody who just stepped down from Google to warn us all that the apocalypse is on the way. Okay, so if you want to be frightened, have a look at that one. So let's think about what intelligence is, specifically how we recognize it in others. As a teacher, I've had this problem for years, okay, and I still haven't discovered. No, sorry, that's not fair. How do we know that we're talking to an intelligent being? How can you tell the difference between simulation and reality? How do you tell another? Well, suppose you were to land on another planet. You know the way, like you always did in Star Trek, you're always dropping into other planets. And of course, that was very convenient because the aliens there always look just like humans, except with funny heads, right? But it might well be that on the other planet, they don't look like human beings, even with funny heads. So how would you tell? Okay, is it just something blowing in the wind or noise that's being made by it? So how do you know you're dealing with some kind of intelligent being? Well, there's no obvious reason why a rational being has to look humanoid, and they don't even have to have our biochemical composition, for it seems possible in principle to have non-carbon based forms of life. It comes to this. If you want to know what something is, and you don't have some kind of metaphysical microscope that allows you to peer into their interior, then there's only one way to come to know what something is, and that's by discerning its characteristic activities and reactivities, and inferring the conditions that make such reactivities and activities possible. I developed this at some length in the paper I wrote for a book, Fesher for Brendan Purcell, called Why Chickens Have No Myths. Okay, if anybody's interested, just email me, okay, and I'll send it to you. Anyway, well, you might be inclined to think, and lay this flattering unction to your soul, that, well, a computer can only do what's it programmed to do. So we humans are still in control. But what if the computer is programmed? What if it's programmed to do is to program itself and change accordingly? Are we still in control? Interesting question. I'm an avid but very average, in fact, probably even below average chess player. And of course, chess programs have been developed over the years, and now they can beat the world champions. But just a few years ago, they developed this program called AlphaZero, and what they gave it was just the rules of chess. In other words, the rules, the moves, and so on. Nothing else. No strategies. No information. No linkage to databases. Nothing. It taught itself to play chess in 4 hours and could beat the strongest existing chess engines. I don't know about you, but I find that incredibly impressive and frightening. Anyway, now, if you're familiar with the books or stories of Philip K. Dick, you probably have seen some of the films made from it, like Blade Runner and so on. You know that his central concern is what makes a human being to be really human, as distinct from a simulacrum, something that looks like a human. You see this all through his works, all through his short stories, all through his novels. Okay, that's the thing. He described himself as a novelistic philosopher rather than a philosophizing novelist. He did a year in philosophy in one of the California universities. So if you watch, for example, the film The Adjustment Bureau, or better still, read the short story, you might begin to wonder whether we're really anything more than glorified machines. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, filmed as Blade Runner, has a large number of fake animals in it, not in the movie, by the way, but in the story, and a smaller but very significant number of fake human beings. And the question all the time is, are we dealing with real human beings? And in the end, is Decker, the guy who's actually supposed to kill all of these replicants, is he one too? How can you tell? For Dick, by the way, just to give you some inkling of where we might go in this in question time, if you're interested, for Philip K. Dick, the criterion that allows us to distinguish between real human beings and imposters is, in a word, empathy. What makes the difference between the real and the fake is that real human beings are capable of showing empathy towards others. Fake human beings are not. So empathy is the ability to enter into the interior life of another human being, to realize that those annoying customers or those not so clever students are cynical, suspicious of the contrary persons just like you. Real human beings then are empathetic. Fake human beings are not. As Dick puts it in Man, Android, and Machine, their handshake is the grip of death, and their smile has the coldness of the grave. So let me put that thought on hold for a moment and move on by asking the question, in experimenting with AI, are we in the process of creating a Frankenstein's monster that we will not be able to control? So I want you to look at the sheet I gave you now, right? And say, what are the dangers of AI? Okay. And you'll notice I won't go through in detail. I'll just mention the heads of them. So job displacement, bias and discrimination, privacy and security risk, lack of transparency, autonomous weapons. I'll come back to that one. Unemployment and economic inequality, ethical decision making, dependence and systems failures, and manipulation and misinformation. Now, the amusing thing, at least amusing to me, is that I generated this by putting a question into ChatGPT asking, what are the dangers of AI? And it generated that in 15 seconds. How about that? Okay. Is that frightening or not? Okay. It's certainly interesting. Anyway, right, so let's move on. So I asked ChatGPT another couple of questions just for fun. I said, are you intelligent? And it said, as an AI language model, I possess a form of artificial intelligence that allows me to generate human-like responses and provide information on a wide range of topics. However, it's important to note that I am not conscious or self-aware in the same way as humans are. And my quote-unquote intelligence, it put the quotes around intelligence, is based on patterns and information present in the training data. My responses are generated based on that training and the input I receive. I asked it, would you pass the Turing test? And those of you familiar with it know that Alan Turing back, oh, nearly about 60, 70 years ago, suggested that the test of whether or not machines, computers were intelligent was that we could have a conversation as we were behind the screen because we couldn't see what they looked like. But if all the responses were appropriate, right, then we, what, how would we deny intelligence to them? And in fact, when I first got interested in artificial intelligence back in the 1980s, somebody had produced a rudimentary sort of psychoanalytic program called Eliza. And you turned on your computer and Eliza came on and said, good morning. And you put in, hello, Eliza, how are you? And Eliza would say, I'm fine, how are you today? And say, oh, I'm not feeling too good. I had a fight with my wife. Tell me more with Eliza. And so this would go on. And it was like, I had about 10 questions. And people were seriously addicted to this. People spent more time talking to Eliza on the computer than they did to anybody else. What would they do now? Well, you've got ChatGPT. Anyway, so I asked it, would you pass the Turing test? And it replied, the Turing test is a subjective evaluation of a machine's ability to exhibit intelligent behavior indistinguishable from that of a human. While I am an advanced AI language model capable of engaging in natural language conversations, passing the Turing test would require a more comprehensive assessment involving real-time interactions and a panel of human judges. Well, that's right. However, it's worth noting, it continued, that the Turing test is not the sole measure of AI's capabilities. It's one benchmark among many for evaluating it, and AI has made significant progress, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally, this will be really annoying, I asked, do you have feelings? And it said, no. As an AI model, I don't have feelings or emotions. I don't experience subjective states of being like humans do. I'm a program designed to process and generate text based on patterns and information, but I lack the ability to feel or to have emotions. So, taking Philip K. Dick's criterion of empathy, they would fail. They cannot be empathetic. They could simulate it, okay, but they couldn't be that. So, here's a summary of some criticisms of the pretensions of AI. As one critic wrote, and I quote, chatbots have no self, that is, no purpose for existing, and therefore can't think. There is no such thing as thought in the abstract. Thought is always someone's thought. And mental activity doesn't constitute thought unless it comes from a thinker who has a reason for thinking. So no thought without a subject. The same critic continued, AI can mimic the lower order functions of the human mind up to a point. It can sort and categorize. AI works wonders in factory automation, examining thousands of images in real time to identify faulty parts or machine wear and tear. It can string together known facts and relationships and produce a credible emulation of a freshman essay. But it can't examine its own premises. Even the simple activity of sorting and categorizing runs into paradoxes and has real difficulty with paradoxes, and it doesn't understand jokes either, which is a real indication. Real indication of intelligence is your ability to appreciate jokes, even the ones I tell. Okay. I found that sort of very interesting. Well, let's move on to when I went through that list that the program had generated. In fact, one was, what was it again? The one I mentioned, I said, I'm going to come back to, oh yeah, autonomous weapons. And this is the one that scares the hell out of everybody. Okay. So, whatever about job losses and all of the other things on that sheet that I handed out, the topic that has our experts really concerned is whether AI would eventually lead to the possibility of human extinction. See, and here we make a connection with our Anthropocene anti-humanists. Okay, it's a good thing for them, though. They might be all gung-ho for AI. They've had that capability, right? Many experts think that high-level AI would produce the possibility of very bad results for us. So on May the 30th of this year, hundreds of AI scientists, along with the CEOs of top AI labs like OpenAI, which is the one that supports ChatGPT, DeepMind, and Anthropic, signed a statement urging caution on AI. And this is what they said. Mitigating the risk of extinction from AI should be a global priority alongside other societal scale risks such as pandemics and nuclear war. Wow. Okay, that's pretty serious stuff. Well, why would they think that? It's possible that progress in AI could lead to the creation of superhumanly smart artificial people with goals that conflict with humanity's interests, though I actually doubt it myself. Anyway, and the ability to pursue them autonomously. Would we then be to them as animals are to us? Not that important in the overall scheme of things, certainly not as important as we are. Okay. Now, the statement about mitigating the risk of extinction claim from the Center for AI Safety, signed by the chief executive of Google DeepMind and et cetera, all of these people, alongside with other major figures in artificial intelligence research. This sentiment was mirrored by Matt Clifford, who's an advisor to Rishi Sunak, who advises the PM on this matter. The statement was also signed by the so-called godfather of AI, Geoffrey Hinton. He's the one who did that scary video that I told you about. So go look at it. Who resigned from his job at Google earlier this year, warning that in the wrong hands, AI could spell the end of humanity. But we might ask, who is this statement intended for? Who are these companies talking to? Because they're the ones busy producing all of this stuff and supporting the research into this stuff. Why are they telling me? I don't have anything to do with it. After all, they're the ones who are creating the products that might extinguish life on Earth. It's a bit like having a burglar complain about your inadequate security arrangements. Okay, it's a bit odd. Okay. Now, from my admittedly limited experience of AI, it doesn't quite come across as apocalyptic just yet. It doesn't feel so world destroying yet. And the statement's doomy words might come as something of a surprise to those of us who have used these particular systems and seen, if you like, the gaps that they can make. However, one critic wrote, and I perhaps should pay attention to this, the systems we have today are a long way from those that we might have tomorrow. Well, that's true. The work going on at the companies who warned us about these issues is vast, could be much more transformative than chatting with a robot. It's all happening in secret and shrouded in both mystery and marketing buzz. But what we can discern is what we might only be a few years away from, systems that are both more powerful and more sinister. So I hope you're all suitably scared now, right? All right, let me add fuel to the fire. Here's some more things to be afraid of. I want to talk about transhumanism. And so we come to the wonderful world of transhumanism, which, to put it somewhat crudely, is the ambition to symbiotically mesh machines and human beings. This is not the work of an isolated, half-crazy Dr. Frankenstein, or if you're a fan of Mel Brooks, Dr. Frankenstein, okay, locked up in a castle somewhere in Central Europe, but a project that has support of many of the great and the good who see it as giving a helping hand to the evolution of man, including, by the way, the great and the good, the WEF, who are very enthusiastic about it. Transhumanism is a philosophical and scientific movement that advocates the use of technologies, genetic engineering, cryonics, artificial intelligence, AI, and nanotechnology to augment human capabilities and improve the human condition. Transhumanists envision a future in which the responsible application of such technologies would enable human beings to slow, reverse, or eliminate the aging process, too late for me, I'm afraid, to achieve corresponding increases in human lifespans, and to enhance human cognitive and sensory capacities. The movement proposes that humans with augmented capabilities will evolve into an enhanced species that transcends humanity, post-human. For transhumanists, quote, biological evolution will eventually be overtaken by advances in genetic, wearable, and implantable technologies that artificially expedite the evolutionary process. So the story is, up to now, as it were, we've been simply pawns in the process of evolution through natural selection. But now we have the capability to take evolution into our own hands and direct the course of human evolution. So transhumanism wants to take us beyond the limits of our current human nature. That is, if what exists after all these changes have taken place is in fact still us. It's a moot point. It emerged in the 90s, 80s, and the 1990s, and by that time it had its own publications and organizations, including the World Transhumanist Association. Though transhumanism is something that has become possibly realizable only relatively recently, the ideas and aspirations behind it go back quite some way. In fact, William Goodwin, who was Shelley's father-in-law and an immensely influential writer in his own day, entertained the possibility of earthly immortality in his novel Saint Leon at the end of the 18th century. And Goodwin's daughter, as you may well know, was of course Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein. The key to our future is GNR, genetics, nanotechnology, and robotics. This is a very crude and preliminary indication, but just to give you some feel for it, we can identify three aspects to transhumanism, which I call repair, enhance, and transcend. So in repair, we're talking about genetic engineering will make it possible for human beings to eliminate many diseases, halt the aging process, enhance our physical and mental abilities. Nanotechnology will enable us to build atomic machines measurable in nanometers, 1/1,000,000th of a millimeter. Robots on this scale can be injected into the bloodstream to continuously repair damage on the cellular level, preventing disease and aging before they begin. Now, on this general point, when it comes to repair, I don't see that there can be any in principle objection to any technology which improves the human condition in that sense, repairs damage. Okay, we have them all the time. When you lose a leg, you can get a prosthetic leg, and now we can get prosthetic devices which can be linked up neurally to your brain so that they can actually operate to your mental command, as it were, rather than just limping along. So again, it doesn't seem to be anything especially problematic about that. The second limb, as it were, of the transhumanist project, however, is enhancement. And here it's kind of back to Methuselah. So it's overcoming aging, so living for centuries rather than decades. I'm not so sure about that one. Refining your senses, supercharging your brains. Anybody see the film Limitless? Okay, you see here, this is it. See, you don't understand anything if you don't go watch the movies, right? Everything I learned from film. Okay, so in Limitless, guy takes this experimental drug and suddenly he goes from being this loser to having this incredible capacity. He teaches himself to play the piano in a couple of days and languages and so on. So what's wrong with that? Overcome your cognitive shortcomings, eliminate involuntary suffering, and allow human beings to break out of our confinement to Earth. Because as long as we are biologically centered in our bodies, as we are, as long as our bodies are essential to our being, we're really not getting off this planet. Okay? It's going to be tough. And then there's transcendence. So some of the transhumanist guys even advocate a post-human condition, the end of humanity's reliance on what they call our congenital bodies, or sometimes human 1.0. Okay, that's like where the preliminary model is going to be a 2.0 coming along. Okay, and we go from our frail version 1.0 human bodies into the far more durable and capable version 2.0 counterparts. This can be done either by, as it were, assimilating what is essentially us, whatever that might be, to a machine, and therefore the machine parts can be repaired, just like you can take your car in and have, you know, something else part put in, for example. Or in the really sort of fantastic future, our consciousness can be, as it were, uploaded to the internet. So we don't have any particular individual substrate at all, no biological body, not even some kind of machinery, and so on. We would come to exist in this kind of internet arena. How do we get from 1 to 2? Well, we do it by, as I said, going into more durable containers, that is machines. It's easy to see, by the way, for those people of this persuasion, the mind is thought to be akin to a computer program, like software that runs on biological brain, which is wetware. Okay, and all we have to do is to transfer the program from wetware to hardware, and we're up and running. That's it. The assumption is that the mind program is the person, as distinct from the body. And that's a very old view. Now, the mind is what you really are. Sometimes language is used of soul. Soul is what you really are. And some versions of Plato, that's what you find. Okay, it's, of course, central to Hinduism. Atman, the self or soul, is what you are. The body is only contingently connected, and you move from one to the other. Eventually, in a process of release, you lose all contact or necessity for being embodied at all, and you return to Brahman, of which you have always been a part. There's an interesting resemblance between what's going on in this transcendent transhumanism and Hinduism. Well, whatever. Whatever about repair and enhancement, what transhumanism is about isn't simply eliminating suffering and denying mortality. It's about rejection of the very idea of a fixed human nature, where the only thing permanent about us is our constant need to change. But transhumanist replacements of humanity by a better, more intelligent, more capable successor species is a similarly worthy sacrifice, even if it ends up creating a world in which human beings can no longer find their own reflection. So transhumanism at this level has, of course, a religious dimension. It has its own secular apocalypse, which he calls the singularity, based on the idea that human life simply can't continue the way it is now, that our world is on the brink of a fundamental transformation. So the goal of transhumanism is not limited to repair or even to enhancement or even to the production of immortality, but to a certain cosmological vision of animating the whole cosmos. It's really striking nowadays that we will not only move out, as it were, in some way into the rest of the universe, but we will actually transform it. Okay? And if you're reminded of Teilhard de Chardin's, I'll make a point on this one, you might be interesting. Anyway. So the ultimate break on the ambition of transgenderism is embodiment. Even though for them the mind has a completely material basis, it need not necessarily be housed in a biological substrate. With the disposal of the body, we will graduate to what they call substrate-independent minds, SIMS, SIMS. In the end, without the restriction of embodiment, we would live in a virtual world. And you might like to reflect, by the way, on the extent to which we already live in a virtual world. The thing I see frequently is, as I travel on the DART, some schoolboys from Black Rock or whatever, getting on the DART, four of them sitting on a seat, and each of them looking into a phone. None of them talking to the others. It's quite striking, think about it. Okay. And there are people, and I'm kind of one of them, who sort of get a little panicky when they get kind of separated from their phone, fear of missing out, something's going on, what's happening? Okay. How certain, by the way, are any of the transhumanist projections or expectations? Well, who can say? Some critics argue that the morphological transformations for which transhumanists yearn will surely almost never come to pass. For example, we'll never upload our minds into computers and live forever in cyberspace. Life, they say, can't be reduced to a series of ones and zeros and in a computer program. And even if we could somehow transfer our thoughts into a software program, the results wouldn't be us, but merely a program capable of mimicking our reactions to external stimuli. And again, we're back to Philip K. Dick. How can you tell the difference between a real human being and a simulacrum? So what are we? Why are we just lumps of living matter? What is the thing, if it is the thing, that asks these questions, the questions that ask these impertinent questions of ChatGPT? Am I just my body? Or if not, is there something else that I am? Am I a self that's only contingently connected to a body, as in the Gnosticism or in Platonism or in Hinduism? Or is myself, if it is anything, just an aspect or a dimension of my body? And these kinds of questions have perplexed us for millennia. As I've indicated, one popular answer is to think of the self as what is most real about me, or my body as some kind of vehicle or container. Sometimes this is expressed as a kind of body-soul dualism, where the soul is taken to be what's really me, and the body is where an accidental carrier to which I'm somehow perhaps temporarily attached. The preeminent Christian theologian and philosopher Thomas Aquinas writes in his commentary on Corinthians 15. I remember being struck by this when I was a student. The Corinthians 15, as you will know, is the famous passage in Corinthians where Paul is talking about the resurrection. And he says, though it be accepted that the soul may continue to exist in another life, this is Thomas Aquinas speaking, it is not I nor any other man. Anima mea non est ego. My soul is not me. Okay, this is not some weird theologian from Belgium with a Belgian name that nobody can spell. Okay? This is Thomas Aquinas. Anima mea, non est ego. My soul is not me. If we re okay, no, I'm going to skip here because there's lots of stuff we can talk about in question time. Anyway, the ultimate goal for human beings, for Christians, is a life lived in the presence of God in a new heaven and a new earth. People think we go to heaven as if it was some kind of cloudy thing. And so, no, you haven't been reading scripture. Okay, you need to read Revelation. New heavens and a new earth. God created us as bodily beings, and it wasn't, if you like, as a trial run so we could become kind of low grade angel eventually. We are essentially embodied creatures. If there is a resurrection, then it's going to be embodiment. I mean, real embodiment. What you say in Mass every Sunday isn't, I believe in the immortality of the soul. I believe in the resurrection of the body. And Paul was getting on quite well, actually, with the Athenians when he spoke to the Areopagus. And they were listening to him until he said the word resurrection. And then they all fell around laughing because they had visions of kind of maggoty bodies rising up through things like Harry, what's it, Hunthausen, the guy who used to do the animations in the 1950s and 60s. Yeah. Anyway, so it seems that the fundamental impulse behind transhumanism is not entirely alien to the religious impulse for some kind of eternal life. The difference would be this, that in transhumanism, we get rid of the body, we upload the mind and re-embody it in mechanical or ideally in an electronic substrate. Whereas for Christians, we get rid of the body, whether we like it or not, at the end of this life. We upload the soul in an intermediate period where the soul's status as not quite a human being is a matter for intensive discussion among theologians. And then re-embodied in a new, improved, defect-free body modeled on the post-resurrection body of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Transhumanism, in its most ambitious version, looks to a kind of apocalypse, whereas the end of the world in the Christian version is not the end of the story, but an introduction to a reconstituted world in which the dead will be raised incorruptible. We shall be changed and live in the presence of God on the new earth, which is our natural place of habitation. For non-believers, which most transhumanists are, surprise, surprise, the end of the world is the end of everything. So the desire to live forever and fully must find an unworldly mode of existence. So, summary then. Transhumanism and its precursor, by the way, and ally transgenderism, about which I won't say anything today unless you force me to do it, right? Because I'm sick of talking about it. Both balk at the restrictions, as they see it, that the human body imposes on them. Transgender ideologists by asserting that gender is independent of human physiology, and transhumanism by rejecting the body's limits to human health, cognitive functioning, immortality, and the cosmological animation of the universe. You might say that both anthropological anti-humanism and transhumanism want human beings to leave the world. AI want human beings to do it by ceasing to exist. Okay, transhumanists want human beings to be transformed into a new species. Christians, on the other hand, believe that embodiment is not an optional extra to being human. True, our vile bodies, as the Anglican burial liturgy has it, are destined for death and dissolution. But as the Word is made flesh, so too our ultimate destiny is the resurrection of the body, not the immortality of the soul. An idea, as I said, that the Athenians found risible when told of it by St. Paul. So what interim conclusions can we reach then regarding transhumanism? Remediation, the first of the trilogy, yes. I don't see any real problem with that. Okay, that seems to me perfectly acceptable. Enhancement, intuitions vary on this. Mine are mostly negative. Okay, I'm suspicious. I'm conservative. Okay, change is something to be regarded, not rejected necessarily, but treated with caution. Transcendence, definitely not. So, a yes, a kind of and a no are my reactions to that. How likely are we all to be subsumed into a virtual world? You might be wondering. Then again, you may not. In the short term, not very likely at all. For those of us of a certain age, that's a kind of consolation. Okay. In the longer term, who can say for sure? I'm inclined to think that the transcendent hopes of transhumanists are more likely than not to be dashed. But that may, of course, be just wishful thinking on my part. What of AI? What kind of impact will that have on our lives? Well, it's already having an impact. If I was a university lecturer, I wouldn't trust anything that any student gave me as being something that they originated themselves. And I would get rid of all continuous assessment and insist on exam scenarios where the whole arena is screened so that no electronic device, which we wouldn't be permitted in there in the first place. But even if students smuggle one in, we wouldn't be able to use. Okay, but that's because I'm a suspicious character, right? Again, it's hard to say of AI. I mean, apart from students, well, certainly some aspects, pattern recognition, sophisticated recognition, retrieval, all those are there, and they're used now, for example, in manufacturing processes. So they can identify, you know, things that are non-standard and reject them and so on. And it's extremely useful. It lowers the cost of our products, okay, and your safety. So yeah, not a problem. And we will have to adapt to that. But once again, the more apocalyptic claims for AI are much harder to believe. Well, we should, I think, as Christians, resist any policies or procedures that diminish human dignity or that would contribute to the displacement of human beings from the biblical commission, which we've never fully satisfied, by the way, and we'll only do so in the life to come, to be fruitful and multiplying, to replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moves on the face of the earth. Thank you very much.